despite our dancing. Hmm? Despite our dancing. Thank you very much.
Erev Tov. That's half my Hebrew. Boker Tov. Shabbat Shalom. Actually, in America, they also say Shabbat Shalom. No. When I was a child, they used to say this. Yeah, yeah. I told them to keep doing it. So, Hare Krishna. Back to home, back to Harish. So, thank you all for coming. I think today we're going to speak about Mahabharata. Is that correct? Maha in Sanskrit means great, and we still have that word in English as magna, like magnify, magnificent, magna carta, that's maha. Just a little linguistic note here, which is more comfortable. It's like an airline seat. If you study linguistics, then you see that where's a lokika? She's a Sanskritist. If you study linguistics, you see that a Sanskrit H tends to become a European G. So, for example, you have the Sanskrit word vahana, which means a vehicle. And so vahan becomes German wagen, as in Volkswagen. Or maha becomes magna. Or mega, like mega bucks. And you take the Sanskrit word aham, like ahamkara. Aham means I, and so the H becomes a G. So from aham, you get the Greek word ego. And also, if you take the word huta, huta in Sanskrit from the verb hu means to invoke. So huta means the one who's invoked, or God. And so if you change the H to G, it becomes a German Gott and the English word God. Not to be confused with the Hebrew word, God. Every class has to be at least one God joke, right? So anyway, so Mahabharata, Magna Bharata, Mega Bharata, which means, and Bharata, of course, is the ancient name for India from the great king Bharata. So, Krishna, or God, as he explains in Bhagavad Gita, comes to this world to fix it. I remember when I was a child, at a certain point, at a certain age, my parents I had three brothers, would leave us at home when we were old enough, and they would go out for the evening. They would say, if you have any trouble, call this number, but please don't have any trouble. And of course, we always found some way to have trouble and call them. So, and if there was a lot of trouble, then of course the parents had to come home and ruin their evening. So, so that's basically it. When, you know, when the kids are having too much trouble, they call the parents, and then Krishna comes into this world to fix everything. So, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, whenever dharmasya glani. Glani means something is deteriorating, something is declining, collapsing. So whenever dharma is collapsing, and abhyutanama dharmasya, I was explaining last night, abhi means aggressively, and ut, up, uttanam, standing up aggressively, rising. Whenever adharma is increasing, then Krishna says, tadatmanam sajamyaham, then I come. I manifest myself. So, Dharma is not a sectarian idea. It's not a Hindu idea. Dharma is a Sanskrit word, but the concept is universal. Because dharma in Sanskrit means justice. Dharma means justice. And it also means law, the law, but in the sense of a sacred law, because in English, for example, or Hebrew, I suppose, you can speak about an unjust law, but you cannot speak about an unjust dharma, because dharma is justice. So dharma in that sense means the right law, the law which is true justice. And so the essence of justice is, first of all, there must be mutual respect. For example, you have your property, which begins with your body. I mean, the first, in a sense, the body, obviously we know everything ultimately belongs to God, but in terms of human justice and human law, one has one's own body, and then the extensions of the body, such as one's clothes, one's home, it can be one's family. And so the idea is that this mutual respect, which is essential to have civilization, ultimately is based on the soul within the body. Because if we were just material bodies, if we were not eternal souls, then in fact the notion of equality would be nonsense, because we are not physically equal. Obviously, I can run much faster than anyone in this room. That's a joke.
Yes, by the power
yeah.
of the mind.
Yeah, yeah, by the power of the mind, not by the power of the legs. So, for example, it's very interesting that in America, which is a country west of here, in America, you have this idea. Well, you have this idea which spread all over the world, which is equality. And in the Declaration of Independence, written by Bacta Tom Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, it begins by saying, "We hold these." And I want to talk about this because this is the basis of democracy, which no one knows because thinking is not popular in the modern world. But the Declaration of Independence, which actually established a vision of how human beings should live together, which spread all around the world, and of course it's also in Israel. Ancient Israel was not a democracy. So, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Now the word self-evident is very important here. Self-evident is a technical philosophical term in epistemology. Again, epistemology is the branch of philosophy which asks the question, how do you know? How do you know? And so on. So, epistemology from the Greek episteme, knowledge. So, whenever you're trying to prove something, as I explained, you can be pushed into an infinite regress of proofs. I think I talked about this before. And so you escape this infinite regress by declaring something is self-evident. If something proves itself, you don't have to prove it. So the basis of any system of thought is the declaration of a self-evident truth. If someone is rational and actually feels the need to give good reasons for what they're doing. So in the Declaration, American Declaration of Independence, it begins by declaring that there is a self-evident truth that we are all equal. Now, materially, this is nonsense. Every branch of material science will prove and prove again that we are not equal. You can give human beings any conceivable kind of test, examination, in terms of athletic ability, artistic ability, mathematical ability, physical strength, anything, and you'll find we're not equal. They have these sort of these silly contests like, you know, Miss America. They have a Miss Israel? Of course, yeah. No country can escape that form of silliness. So I mean, if they have a Miss Israel contest, or Miss America, or Miss Guatemala, then, again, it's based on the assumption that you can rate beauty, that some people have more beautiful bodies than others. So there's no material sense in which we're equal. So if equality is, which is so obvious, Jefferson claims it's not only true, it's self-evidently true, which means anyone that's not a fool can see it. So what is that equality? If it cannot be physical, there's only one option left. It's metaphysical. And the Greek meta means beyond or after. So we are spiritually equal. That's the philosophical goose that laid the golden egg. Because if you take away our spiritual equality, we are not equal, period. And therefore, any type of political system based on the notion of equality is simply nonsense.
That's what the Jews
say. What's that?
That's what the Jews say.
That what?
The Jews.
Yes. So, and so Jefferson says the truth is self-evident. We hold these truths to be self-evident that we are all created equal. According to the American political system is based on a religious idea. Namely, that we are created equal. We're not born equal. It's not we don't hatch equal. I mean, it's not that we just happen to be equal. We are created equal, that we are all men are created equal, endowed by a creator with the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So inalienable is a legal term. Jefferson was very bright. Inalienable is a legal term, which means that no other power can deprive you, can legitimately deprive you of that right. My mother always said I should be a lawyer. But of course, every Jewish mother says her son should be a lawyer. So the inalienable right to life, liberty, and so on. So democracy is actually based on a spiritual idea. Democracy is actually based on a spiritual idea, because the spiritual idea is the basis of justice. For example, take the what's always held up as the greatest example of pure democracy, which is Athens, Greece, ancient Athens. Because as we know, in Israel or in America or any of these countries, we actually have a type of republican democracy. It's not that every Israeli goes to a big auditorium and votes on everything. So in a system where you elect leaders and they make decisions, that's called republican democracy. So the reason that in Athens, ancient Athens, the people had this pure democracy where all the citizens actually came together and voted, the reason they could do this is very simple. They had so many slaves. Mm-hmm. So when you have a lot of slaves at home, you have time for committee meetings. Sure, I can go to that meeting. So you could even argue that in Western civilization, the idea that everyone is equal actually came from the Judeo-Christian tradition. So anyway, getting back to the Mahabharata and the concept of Dharma. The concept of Dharma is not an Indian idea. It's a universal concept that because everyone is ultimately a spiritual being, not only humans, every living being is ultimately a spiritual being. Therefore, every living being has a right to respect, to dignity, and to justice. And that's what Krishna means. So just as, for example, in Israel or any country, if, let's say, in a particular town, the leaders of the town are not following the law or they are harassing certain people against the law, it's the duty of the central government to come and restore justice. That's exactly what Krishna does. Krishna creates the world. He creates the universe. And when injustice is out of control, Krishna personally comes to restore justice. And that's what he says. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam. To save good people and to red card, you know, like in soccer, the bad people. And dharma sangstapanartaya, to reestablish dharma. So what did Krishna actually do? First of all, Krishna is not just a divine bully. Krishna could just come here and you know, force everyone, like anyone that doesn't do exactly what I want will experience terrible pain until they do exactly what I want. So you have to look at it from Krishna's point of view. Did any of you see that movie, Bruce Almighty? Yeah. Yes, that's the point. So Ishvara Krishna saw, put him down as having seen it. So, the idea is that Krishna plans his descent into this world, because from God's point of view, he is committed to respecting everyone's free will. Because if Krishna takes away our free will, then we're not really persons. What are we? We become slaves, mindless slaves, or machines. And so the whole reason that Krishna has made a world with innumerable souls is these souls are meant to be like God. They're meant to be like little gods, in the sense of achieving goodness and dignity and beauty and knowledge and acting like God. And so if you rob someone of their free will, then if goodness is something which must be voluntary. Goodness must be voluntary. For example, if you're walking down the street and let's say, I don't know, 1,000 shekels fall out of your pocket and you don't know it, and then some hungry, poor person comes along and takes the money and buys food, you don't get credit for charity. It's not that you gave charity. So goodness, by definition, is intentional. And therefore, you cannot force people to be good. I could say, for example, if you say to someone, if you don't stop eating meat, I'll kill you. And let's say for some reason you're lost on some island, you know, like typical scene where only two people on this island. And so if you force someone to do something, there's no virtue in it. Other than that, a little joke about the English, that there were these two Englishmen trapped on this island in the middle of the ocean, and they never spoke to each other for years until they rescued. They never spoke a word to each other. So someone asked them when they were rescued, why didn't you talk to each other? And they said, well, we were never introduced.
That would never happen
to you ever. No. So this is from Krishna's point of view. Of course, Krishna does, let's say, people who are actually like people who are really bad people and doing bad things, Krishna stops them from doing that. But how can souls be brought back to God without interfering with their free will? For example, if you have children, they reach a certain age where you can't order them to do this or that, and so you have to persuade them, and the only hope is to persuade them. And so how does Krishna persuade people to come back to their real home? I sometimes give this example that in the late 1960s, when I was a student at Berkeley, during all the political agitation, of course I was extremely young in 1969, but there was a very common thing there was a very common thing going on then, where children were leaving home. Berkeley was, well, maybe it's not the best expression in Israel, but Mecca, in the sense of that Berkeley was like the place all the young people in the country, or not the world, you know, wanted to go. And so I was a student there, and young people would arrive there from everywhere. But a lot of these young people, they left their homes because there was a real problem between generations. Basically, our parents were for the war in Vietnam. We were against the war in Vietnam. We were for civil rights. Our parents were a little uneasy about civil rights and all that. And so basically, obviously young people were for sexual freedom. No big surprise there. And of course, the parents were for sexual restraint. So on every issue, parents and children were just completely divided. And they called it the generation gap. So children were leaving home, and many of them are going to Berkeley. So they had a community newspaper there called the Berkeley Barb. And, of course, newspapers get their revenue from their advertising. So half the newspaper consisted of classified ads in the back of the paper of parents trying to find their children. And I used to sometimes read these ads. They were very poignant, like, Johnny, come home, everything is forgiven. Or, Susie, your room is just as you left it. We're, you know, and So it was kind of, it was really pathetic, because all these parents desperately trying to find their children. So Krishna comes to this world trying to persuade his children to come back to their real home. Obviously, this world is not our real home, because it vanishes, or you vanish. And why is it so painful? Why is it so... why do people suffer so much when someone they love leaves this world? Why do people suffer so much when they have to leave this world? Because it's unnatural. And despite all this pseudo-philosophy trying to convince us it's natural, actually it's unnatural. It's unnatural because we're eternal. It's just like if you fall in love and you form a relationship, and then, in the words of all those great American songs, "You done me wrong." So if people are in a relationship and then the other person leaves, why do we suffer so much? Because it's unnatural, among other things. People talk about, like, true love never dies, but in this world, love always dies. Or the lovers die. So we are meant to live in an eternal atmosphere. We are meant to have eternal friendship, eternal family, eternal lovers. We are meant to live forever. We're not meant to have the body grow old and look very strange. Fortunately, I haven't experienced the aging process. Or maybe is it that my disciples always Photoshop my pictures? Anyway, so... But it's a fact, as you get older, more and more, I look in the mirror and I think, oh my God, who is that?
My father.
It's your father. So actually, because it's not, it isn't us. It's like, you know, I don't know about you, when I was young, whenever I looked at a picture of myself when I was a teenager, I was just like, you know, the pictures where I look really good, that's how I really look. And the pictures that look bad, no, that doesn't look at all like me. So it's this natural desire. We want to be beautiful. We want to be happy. We want to fall in love and always be in love. And because that's our real life. That's who we really are. And we're down now. We're down here in these material bodies. So Krishna comes. It's not that Krishna's lonely or he has self-esteem problems and needs more people to surrender to him. Krishna comes down here because for our good. He wants to see us happy. Prabhupada used to always give this example. Back in the late 60s, there were hippies. Do you still know what that word means?
Yep.
Hippies? Okay. One time Prabhupada was asked, "You always say hippies. Do you know what a hippie is?" And Prabhupada laughed and said, "Yes, something wonderful." Like something amazing. So Prabhupada came from a society where anyone who has money really holds on to it. And not only holds on to it, but flaunts it, shows it, like, "I've got money." Because in third world countries, people really, you know, they're very serious about money. And so when Prabhupada came to America back then in the late 60s and saw that young people from rich families were leaving their rich families and, like, sleeping in the street and just becoming bums, he was just astonished. He was astonished because in India, no one would do that unless they were clinically insane. And so Prabhupada grabbed that as a great metaphor, or as a great analogy, that because all of us are children of someone who is infinitely rich. Basically, he owns everything. Not only all the real estate in Kesaria, but everything. I mean, all the planets. Krishna says, "Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. I am the great Lord," which also has a sense of proprietor. "I am the great Lord of all worlds." So Krishna has, of course, six opulences, infinite wealth. Krishna, God, infinite wealth, infinite beauty, infinite strength, infinite intelligence, renunciation, and wisdom. So therefore, we can say objectively that if someone is not attracted to God or Krishna, once they know who God is, there is some envy there, because everything we want beauty. We want to be beautiful. In Southern California, in Los Angeles, in the Yellow Pages, well, Yellow Pages, that's like, okay, there used to be something called the Yellow Pages.
The page that has.
What?
You have it called the Gold Pages.
Okay, the Gold Pages. Anyway, the commercial section of the phone book. And in Los Angeles, the section on cosmetic surgery is like that big. So we want to be beautiful. You know, Hollywood. We want to be beautiful and we want to be with beauty. We want to live in a beautiful place. Why is it when you go to rich neighborhoods, they have more beautiful parks and, you know, walking trails and things like that? Because people want beauty. If they can afford it, they buy it. People want to be beautiful, their bodies. They want to attract other beautiful people. They want a beautiful person to love them. Or they want to own a beautiful person. Actually, it reminds me of this other funny thing. I'll tell you quickly. In Los Angeles, it was a billboard, this big advertisement. It was an advertisement for this sort of upscale outdoor shopping center in the rich part of Los Angeles. And their advertising theme was that it's not what you expect. Like, come here because, you know, it's not what you expect. And so they had this, because it's of course, it's L.A., it's Hollywood. So they had this big picture of this what they call a trophy blonde. You know, like sort of like this hourglass blonde lady, you know, like a trophy blonde. And a young lady. And then they had this sort of old guy who was just some old little guy about half her size. And so he's standing there, what they would call a schlep. And so then the sign said, "He's not rich, she's really in love." But anyway, so in this world, we want all these things. So all the things we want, beauty, wealth, power, intelligence, and detachment. For example, detachment is a form of power or freedom. If you are attached to someone, they have power over you. If they tell you one day, I don't like you anymore, your whole world collapses. Your whole world collapses. So the more we're attached to someone, the less freedom we have. It's just mathematical. By the way, this doesn't mean you can't love someone, because love is different. In real love, you don't want anything. Attachment means I need something from you. So Krishna's opulence of detachment means total freedom. Because to be attached to something literally means you're not free from it. You're attached to it. And so when you're detached, which is the precondition for real love, by the way, because real love means that I just love you. It's not business. It's not a deal like, okay, you tell me how wonderful I am and I'll tell you how wonderful you are. It's love. You just love someone. So why do we want all these things? First of all, I wanted to say we want all these things, but they exist infinitely in Krishna. So if you say you want beauty, and you do want beauty in your life, you want beauty in your life, and Krishna is infinitely beautiful, how could you not want Krishna? You do want beauty, and Krishna is infinitely beautiful. You do want, let's say, enough wealth to live peacefully and comfortably, and Krishna is infinitely wealthy. We do admire, we're attracted to intelligence, and Krishna is infinitely intelligent. So everything we actually want exists infinitely in Krishna. So to say, I don't want Krishna, something else must be going on there. Because if someone says, for example, I want vanilla ice cream, you say, okay, here's some vanilla ice cream. I don't want it, but I want vanilla ice cream. What's going on? There's something, what else is going on there?
You have to know that Krishna is everything that you say.
That's right. No, even people do know, actually. Because the only catch is that Krishna is God and you're not. That's the only problem. And for some people, that's a huge problem. Because even if someone is not a philosophical atheist, they may be a psychological atheist. In other words, someone may say, if you ask someone, "Do you believe in God?" "Yes, I believe in God," but psychologically, oh, yeah, that plant tends to attack people. It's don't sue us. So that's America. So, in other words, I may philosophically say I believe in God, or I may even believe in God, but emotionally, psychologically, in my daily life, I'm the center of my life. And I want to remain the center of my own life. I don't want Krishna to be the center. I want to be the center. I want to see everything revolving around me. Now, if you think about it, that's what sense gratification is. It means if I see something, I want that. I don't want it for Krishna, I want it for me. And if I don't like something, even though Krishna may like it, for example, in relationship between devotees, obviously it's pleasing to Krishna if devotees can cooperate together and get along. But I may say, I just don't like this person. So therefore, I'm not thinking, well, what does Krishna want? I'm thinking, what do I want? So, or for example, Krishna may want me to do some service, and I think, nah, I don't like the weather there. It's interesting, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, if we give up our duty because we fear that I won't be completely comfortable. We're not talking about going into a dangerous situation or anything like that, but just, nah, I won't like it. But it's really my duty. So, if we are accepting things and rejecting things because we like them or don't like them, then emotionally, psychologically, we're not really in a God-centered world. And so that's why in Krishna consciousness, without doing anything crazy or rash, but I mean, we have to think that way, that is this good for Krishna? And because whatever is good for Krishna is good for me. I'm part of Krishna. I'm part of Krishna. I mean, we all are. It's not just me. We are all part of Krishna. So, Prabhupada always gave these beautiful examples, like the hand is part of the body. So what if the hand, this is Prabhupada's example, what if the hand one day thought, nah, the body's exploiting me, I have to keep giving food to the body. I'm just going to go independent. So the hand decides, I'm going to eat by myself. So even if you have the most powerful hand on earth, you know, you can crush granite in your bare hand. Still, the hand cannot eat. Hands don't eat. That's not what they do. The hand eats by feeding the whole body. So in the act of feeding the body, the hand eats. Or another example actually given in the Bhagavatam, that a tree, the branches and leaves of a tree cannot drink water. The tree lives by drinking water, and of course sunshine and minerals in the earth. But only the roots can drink. So you water the root of a tree. So if we are trying to enjoy without Krishna, it's like the hand trying to eat. If the hand tries to eat, the hand itself will starve. The hand must give the food to the body. So when we offer our devotion, we offer our service to Krishna, when we try to make Krishna happy, we become happy because we're part of Krishna. So Krishna comes to this world to explain all these things. Krishna comes to this world basically to tap us on the shoulder and say, can we talk about this? About your karma? So that's why, but then, so how does Krishna do it? So Krishna has this brilliant idea. First of all, and this is totally Harish, and that is that when Krishna comes to this world, he fits in with society. He actually fits in with society because the Bhagavatam actually says about Krishna, Nato Natya Dharojata. He even dresses like everybody. Because nato means an actor, and natya means like costume. Natya daro, like an actor in costume. It's just like Lord Chaitanya. When Sanatana Goswami came to Lord Chaitanya and he had his sort of his Gucci chowder, you know, this very expensive designer chowder, because he had been a rich person. So Lord Chaitanya said, no, you need to get rid of that and just get, you know, well, in America it would be Kmart. So, for the Salvation Army.
Tarjay.
Yes, Tarjay, yes. So he told him to, why? Because that was the standard for that culture. It's not eternal Vedic culture. It was the standard in the early 1500s, first part of the 16th century in northern India. And to give an example, Prabhupada wore silk clothes and, you know, rings, you know, sometimes jewels. Why? I mean, he didn't care about it. He couldn't care less about it. But he was in a world where, like in India, people admire wealth. And in the West, people admire wealth. So you have Prabhupada doing exactly the opposite of Sanatana Goswami, but doing exactly the same thing. And that is fitting into their society. So when Krishna comes, Krishna actually comes because Krishna knows that, first of all, you have to allow people to identify with you, and then you can talk to them. Then you can persuade them. If people think you're the man from Mars, so, yes. So anyway, so Krishna personally comes and fits into human society. If you see how Krishna acted in Vrindavan, how he acted in when he became a prince in Mathura and Dwarka, he fit into that society, but he was God. So he showed two things. Number one, hey, I'm just one of you. Sorry, Tulsi. He said, I'm just one of you, so people could identify with him, people would become attached to him, but then he did amazing things because he's God. So he did both. He fits in, he becomes one of us. As the Bhagavatam says in the first canto, the first chapter of the Bhagavatam, he comes kapata manusha, as a sort of a pretending to be a human being. But he does pretend to be a human being, and so he enters into the human world, and people identify with him and are interested in him, and then he shows, actually, do you want to know who I really am? And then he explains that he's God. So this is what Krishna does. And Krishna comes to attract us. Krishna comes to attract us, and therefore he designs all these pastimes. He choreographs, he designs all these pastimes. Now, there's another issue that Krishna has to deal with, and that is culture changes. So, for example, Krishna has to display pastimes, which are interesting, not only at the time he performs them, but what about 1,000 years from then? What about 2,000 years later? What about now, 5,000 years later? So how do you perform pastimes which 5,000 years later in a completely different world order are still interesting? And yet Krishna did it. However, different cultures at different stages in history, different civilizations become attached to Krishna Leela, for example, in India, and then they tell the stories in a way that they find attractive. For example, if you look at, let's say if you look at movies in the 1920s and 30s and movies today, some things are universal. Some, in terms of plot development, in terms of character and dialogue and so on, some things are universal, but some things are very different. Some things are very different, and sometimes we like the old way better. Sometimes we like some of the new things. And so, in the same way, it is our responsibility, actually, to take these pastimes of Krishna and take them as they are, not change them, of course, we can't, but to find the universal message. And where we have to understand how Krishna's pastimes are universal, and then present them to the world. So in Mahabharata, The Mahabharata is kind of a combination of Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, and I guess in the Old Testament. So, how much time do we have? What time is it now? Oh, wow, so much more time?
Half an hour, 1 hour.
Do you know my rates? So, are you sure you can afford it? So, just kidding. So after all that introduction, I'll just briefly, what actually happened to the Mahabharata? First of all, the Mahabharata is a multi-generational story. The main story, the central story of the Mahabharata actually covers about 7 or 8 generations. And so people don't always know this, so I'll explain it. The Mahabharata actually begins, in other words, the main story, not literally the physical text, but the main story, let's say it's of Krishna coming to this world, actually begins in the 8th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because in the 8th canto of the Bhagavatam, there is a great battle on higher planets between the devas and the asuras, or asuras and asuras, the good guys and the bad guys. I mean, everywhere in Israel, there are good guys and bad guys. In America, go anywhere in the world, and there's, you know, good guys and bad guys. So in the universe, there was this great battle described in the 8th canto, and the devas, the godly people who govern the universe on behalf of God, they won with Krishna's help. But then if you study insurgencies, the asuras planned a counterattack. And so if you study the nature of insurgencies all around the world, in other words, people who are revolting against the government but cannot, or want to take power but cannot directly march on the capital and try to take the government. So typically what insurgencies do when they're not prepared for open combat with the government power is they go to some place which geographically is inaccessible or difficult. For example, right now in Colombia, they still have that ongoing problem with FARC, that sort of violent Marxist group. And so they're in the jungle. They're in the jungle. Why? Because in the jungle, it's hard to find you, and it's hard to bring in heavy equipment, and so on and so forth. Or in Chechnya, the people went into the mountains. Or, for example, in North Africa, typically groups will go to the desert, like in Sudan, for example.
Same in Israel.
Yeah, you go to the desert. So, in other words, you go to some place where it's hard to find you, and where it's problematic. So basically, over 5,000 years, so probably about maybe 5,300 or 5,400 years ago, before several generations before Krishna came, there was an insurgency in the universe. So the place when the asuras wanted to build back their strength, organize, and get prepared to again fight to take over the universe, they decided that they would find a remote planet. They would find a remote planet where they would not be suspected, take over that planet, and use it as a so-called Death Star, you know, Star Wars, to again fight for control of the universe. The planet they chose was Earth. And that's how the whole story starts. And that's actually what happened. Therefore, in the beginning of Prabhupada's Krishna book, when he says, once the world was overburdened by the unnecessary defense forces of demons disguised as kings, he doesn't mean that real kings are very nice and Krishna conscious and they weren't, so they weren't real kings. That's not the point. The point is they were aliens. They were actually from other planets. And so they were very clever, because it's like, you know, what's that great line from Star Wars? Luke, you don't understand the power of the dark side of the Force. I'm from Hollywood. So, so it's interesting that actually George Lucas got this idea of the cosmic force from Vedic culture. He studied world so-called mythology. And It came from actually Japanese martial arts philosophy. Let the force. But actually, in Japanese martial arts, which came from India, for example, jiu-jitsu. You've heard of jiu-jitsu. That's actually Sanskrit jiu-jitsu, which means a warrior. And so this idea, the force is actually dharma. So, for example, you have statements in Mahabharata like dharma rakshita rakshati. When dharma is protected, it protects. Like when you protect the force protects you. And dharma hingsita hingsati. When dharma is injured, it injures. If you injure dharma, it will destroy you. And so, therefore, considering this, the power of the force, or the power of dharma, the asuras had this very interesting strategy that they would... Basically, a two-part strategy to take over Earth, which was very clever. And if there's no God, it was a great strategy. So the first idea was that they would take birth as princes in the most powerful royal families. And therefore, without firing an arrow, they would just take over the most powerful political dynasties on Earth. And they also had this very interesting idea, which you find in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, Kamsa's ministers preach this to Kamsa, that they believed that by killing Brahmins, some of them believed that, like Kamsa, by killing Brahmins you could destroy Krishna. So how could they think this way? It's actually, it's a very logical idea if you just have one mistaken premise. And that is, I mean, have you ever seen Harry Potter movies? Harry Potter? Harry Peter. Anyway, so Harry Potter is very interesting because there you have not a mystic worldview, but a magical worldview, and they're different. Because a mystical worldview means that there are powers beyond the ordinary physical powers, but in a mystical worldview, like Krishna consciousness, we still live in a rational universe where there are direct reasons that make sense. For example, we are not the body, we are the soul. So it's not just magical, it makes sense that if you're not the body, that the more you're conscious of the soul, the more you're detached from the body. If there's a God, and God is rational, as Krishna explains, Krishna emphasizes in Bhagavad Gita, he is rational, he's reasonable, he does things for good reasons, he reciprocates with people, he's not whimsical. So in a mystical worldview, there are greater powers. There may be spiritual entities, but we still live in a rational universe that obeys reasonable laws of justice. But in a magical worldview, it's not like that. Think Harry Potter, for example. You take the skin of a lizard and drop some water on it and say shabam, shabam or something, and then you turn your enemy into a fruitive worker. Or, I'm just kidding. You turn your enemy into a into a rhinoceros or
like Monty Python.
Yeah. So in other words, there's no logical relation. It doesn't obey, just as there are laws of physics, there are also laws of metaphysics. It's not magical, it's simply laws of a higher order. But in magic, there's no logical relationship between what you do and what happens. So the demons believed, the asuras believed, that the sacrifice creates power. Vedic sacrifice creates power by these magical means. It just does. It creates power. And then whoever performs the sacrifice can direct the power, can give the power to whomever they want. It's just like if you make money, you can give the money to whoever you want. If you have political power, you can use that political power to benefit whoever you want. And so if you perform a Vedic sacrifice and create power, create this cosmic power, you can then invest that power in anyone you like. And so the demons believed, and actually this is a very modern idea in a sense, a lot of people think this way, even New Age people, that when you perform Vedic sacrifice and create this power, because the sacrifice is being done in the name of Krishna or to Vishnu, it's not that Vishnu is empowering the Brahmins, they are empowering Vishnu. Because the sacrifice works with or without God. This is Mimamsa philosophy. In that sense, the Asuras were Mimamsa philosophers who believed that it's the mechanism that creates power. You don't need God. You don't need demigods, because the mechanism itself, like if you have a jet plane, you don't need God. If the jet plane obeys the laws of good, you know, aerodynamic engineering, it flies. It's not about God, it's about the engineering. And so this was they had an engineering view of life, that if you perform the right sacrifice, it creates power. And because the Brahmins do it for Vishnu, that's where he gets his power. So if you kill the Brahmins and they stop performing these sacrifices, he doesn't get his power. It's just like, for example, people thought Saudi Arabia was sending money to the Islamic State. So it's not that they're God, but they're getting money from certain sources. And so in the same way, cut off the funding, cut off the mystic funding to Vishnu, and then Vishnu loses his power. So therefore they wanted to kill Brahmins. But how do you kill Brahmins without violating Dharma so heavily that you're destroyed by violating, you know, Dharma? And so they had a very clever idea of how to do this. They would take birth by their power as animals, violent animals in the forests and jungles, lions, tigers, and so on, and they would kill these sages. Because when a wild animal kills a sage, it's not against the laws of nature. Because wild animals, that's what they do. They attack and kill other beings. So they had this whole plan. Now, they also came to Earth at a very special time. What I'm telling you is all from the Shastra. This is not just, you know, I had too much prasad and the sugar one day. And started to hallucinate. So, anyway, now, something else had happened at Earth. Something else took place on Earth, which in a sense made Earth more vulnerable, which also explains why the Asuras chose Earth. Why did they choose to come to Earth? What happened is that many generations before Krishna, I don't know how many, you could say maybe 7 or 8 generations before Krishna came to this world, the kings of the world, the political leaders, became so greedy for power that they began to attack the Brahmins and even kill Brahmins. So if you study the Mahabharata, what you find is these two highest social classes, the sages and the kings, the royalty, they work together, they're supposed to work together, but there was tension sometimes. And so you find, you know, a number of incidents in the Mahabharata, even in the Bhagavatam, where there's real tension between these two powerful classes. And sometimes they actually attack each other. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but it was the real world. So because of a certain tension between the sages and the kings, the kings decided to get rid of this nuisance, this problem of these sages, and so some kings killed some sages. Therefore, the Lord invested his power, Shakti Avesh, in Parashuram. Parashuram came as a Brahmin and killed all these evil kings. So, the evil kings are gone, but there's a little problem. They're just anarchy. There are no rulers. And so, at that point, I mean, obviously Parashuram didn't kill the warrior women, because, I mean, Kshatriya, the Kshatriyas, there's Kshatriya and Kshatriya. It's like Brahmana, Brahmani, Kshatriya, Kshatriya, and so on. Vaishya, Vaishya, male and female. So you had all these women born in noble families, princesses and queens, and there were no husbands in their social order. Therefore, an arrangement was made that the women approached the purest, the most exalted sages, and the sages gave them sons. Now the result of this was that you had this amazing new class of rulers on Earth who were like saintly sages, like Brahmins. And so the result of it was that the Earth, although this is getting near the end of Dwapara Yuga, the third of four ages, despite that fact, the Earth again entered like a type of golden age. And the Mahabharata emphasizes there's no crime. No one ever lies. No one cheats. No one steals. No one ever harms anyone else. And so what are the kings doing? They're just, well, they don't go fishing because it's, you know, that you don't do that in Satyuga. They are, the kings are sitting down on sacred rivers and just practicing yoga. Because there's no criminals. And everyone pays their taxes and no one does anything wrong. So they just sit down and do yoga and meditate. For example, the powerful Kuru dynasty, King Pratipa, who's the Kuru king and the father of Shantanu, who really starts the main story of Mahabharata, Shantanu. Pratipa, he's on the bank of the Ganges meditating and trying to benefit the world, not by riding around and, you know, smashing the bad guys and helping the people, because there's no one to help. So he's just, you know, meditating on universal good and meditating on Krishna and through mystic yoga trying to benefit the world. Now there's another king, actually a prince, who has a problem. This prince is named Vasu. And he's a Chedi prince. He's a prince of Chedi. Chedi, if you know the geography of India, if you know where Delhi is, India's kind of like a diamond shape. And up in the north central part is Delhi. If you go straight down from Delhi, you come to Vrindavan and Mathura, and then Agra, Taj Mahal. And then if you just keep going south, about another, maybe, you know, 100, 200 miles, a couple hundred miles, you come to Jhansi, where Prabhupada used to live, and then into Madhya Pradesh. So in that area, sort of like, you know, farther south, maybe like a couple hundred miles south of Agra, was a kingdom called Chedi. And maybe 100 miles south of Agra. And so that was Chedi. And so there was a Chedi prince. Actually, there was a prince named Vasu who wasn't from Chedi. But he had a problem. That is, he was a prince without a kingdom. Because if you study the history of the world, I mean, actually, even the history of Israel, or the history of Europe, or the history of anywhere, India, there are often more princes than there are kingdoms to go around. That was actually a huge historical problem in Israel, because Herod, you know, kind of kept things under control, but his sons were totally, like, useless. And it was because the sons of Herod were causing so much trouble and fighting with each other so much that the Romans sent in Pontius Pilate to direct Roman governor, and basically when everything played out, the Jews lost Israel for 2,000 years. So it was a so bad monarchy. So it can be a major problem because they revolted against this direct Roman rule. Anyway, so Vasu was a prince that didn't have a kingdom, and so he was kind of obviously discouraged. He thought, well, I'm gonna do better than a kingdom. So he sat down to meditate, performing austerities to get power, and he thought, I can become Indra. Who wants to be a king of this little planet? I can be a king of heaven. I can be a king of the whole universe. And so Indra looked down and thought, not good. Now, Indra came to speak to this Vasu, this prince. And he told him that, basically, that your dharma is not to, you know, your dharma is really to protect this world. And here I'm filling in some logical steps. I mean, everything I've told you so far is right out of the Mahabharata. And basically, everything I'm about to tell you is from Mahabharata. But in terms of the motives now, this is my analysis as a historian, if you look at the whole picture, because there are gaps in the story. Basically, Indra told him that the earth... Okay, one important detail. It was precisely at this time when the earth was so peaceful and happy, it was Camelot, it was the Satya Yuga, you know, everything was wonderful. It was exactly at that time that the Asuras, the demons, came down to earth. And they didn't just immediately appear as, you know, bad guys, because first they took birth. They took birth in important royal families, and so it would actually take a generation for them to start to take power of different countries. And so at that time, Indra came down and said, you really need to stay here on Earth because the Earth has been invaded. And that timing is from the Mahabharata. So Vasu undoubtedly told Indra, hey, I haven't got a kingdom. I haven't got an army. You know, it's like individuals don't have armies. Countries have armies. And I haven't got a country. So Indra told him, I will make you the king of Chedi. And it's interesting because Prabhupada often says that the king of Hastinapur, the Kuru king, was the emperor. But actually, in this case, Indra makes the king of Chedi the emperor of the world. And that's emphasized in the Mahabharata. That because Pratipa, the Kuru king, was just doing his yoga on the bank of the Ganges. And so it was actually Vasu. He made him the king of Chedi. And he made him the emperor of the world. He made him the most powerful king in the world. Now, this Vasu had five sons. The oldest son was Brihadratha. And he was so powerful, Vasu, that he could give kingdoms away to all five sons. He didn't divide Chedi. It's very interesting because if you read the Mahabharata sort of as like a professional historian, really look for these things, actually all five sons ruled Chedi together. He did not divide their homeland, Chedi. So they all five had the joint rule of Chedi, but then he gave each of them another kingdom. That's how powerful he was. He could just give kingdoms away. He could give countries away. And one of the countries he gave away was called a very famous country back then. Because India was like Europe. Those were countries. Everything that today is a state in India, for thousands of years was a country. And so he gave him Magadha, which today is Bihar. It's between like Delhi and Calcutta. There's a state. He gave him Magadha, which was, it was such an important state that the two most important empires in the last 3,000 years or last 2,500 years in India were there in Magadha, the Mauryan Empire and then the Gupta Empire. So it was an important part of India. He gave him Magadha. Now what's interesting is this family of Vasu was empowered by Indra to protect the world from this Asura invasion. But the Asuras, what did they do? The greatest Asura, the most powerful Asura, took birth as the prince, the heir to the throne, in Magadha, as he became Jarasandha. The grandson of Vasu. It's very interesting because Vasu also had a very beautiful daughter named Satyavati who gave birth to Vyasadeva. So Vasu is the grandfather of Veda Vyasa, the incarnation of Krishna, and of Jarasandha, direct grandfather. So at this point, in my calculation, this is the point at which Bhumi, the goddess of the earth, went to see Brahma because things were out of control. Indra had empowered this family to protect the world from the Asuras, and the Asuras were taking over that family without violating Dharma. So at this point, the Asuras had so much power that it was beyond even Indra's power to deal with it. Indra, of course, is Jupiter. And Jupiter is a Sanskrit word, you may know, because Ju in Sanskrit means heaven, and Pitra is father, like Pitha. So Ju Pitra, the father of heaven, Jupiter. It shows you the obvious connections between classical civilization and Vedic civilization. So anyway, at this point, because if you say the Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto says that Bhumi, the earth goddess, went to Brahma and said that, I can't deal with this. So at what point did she go? So you have to take that event, but then you have to look at the history of the time, all these different generations of kings, and at what point? Because at some times, things are going great. Why would Bhumi go there? So, in my calculation, this is the point she must have gone to Brahma. Because Indra had a plan. Like, I don't need Vishnu, I can do this. It's just like in the 8th canto. Because, first of all, he doesn't want to bother Vishnu. And second of all, he's Indra. He doesn't want to always have to call home to Dad. Like, Dad, can you help me? He wants to do it himself. So, for example, in the 8th canto, when the Devas and the Asuras have their big battle, Indra wants to do it himself. And he actually is winning, but then the Asuras resort to this sort of this mystic power. This, like, they break the rules. They use like forbidden weapons. It's like you know, what's his name? Bashar al-Assad with his chemical weapons, which he doesn't use except when he uses them. And so even in the modern world, with all of its insanity, there are certain rules of warfare. And there are always rules. And so there were rules of warfare even between the Devas and the Asuras, and the Asuras violated those rules, brought in forbidden weapons, and it was at that time that Indra had no choice but to invoke Vishnu. And then Vishnu came, and the good guys won. So it sort of plays out again, because Indra, naturally, he wants to do his job. It's like, if you have a service, you want to do your service. You don't want to have to say, I can't do it, and then have someone else come and do it for you. So just as in the eighth canto, Indra had to call Vishnu. So again, Indra had a plan to protect the earth and the Asuras, but it didn't work. Because they actually infiltrated and were taking over the very family that was empowered to protect the earth. So at that point, Bhumi goes to Brahma. Brahma says, I need to take this to the supervisor. So he goes to Vishnu. It's like, you know, in a company, like, I can't deal with this, I have to talk to my boss. So Brahma goes to Vishnu, and then Vishnu says, we can deal with this. So Vishnu decides, okay, I will personally come to the world, and he tells the demigods, you should empower great souls to come down also, because we're going to take care of business. So Vishnu comes down, of course Krishna comes, and then Indra, and then the Pandavas, it's interesting because in the Bhagavatam, the 10th canto, what Vishnu what literally says to the demigods is Yadu Shupa Janyatam, that you should prepare to take birth in the Yadu dynasty. And yet, for example, we see that the god Indra invested his power in Arjuna, and of course the wind, Vayu, who's the most powerful god, in Bhima, and Dharma in Yudhisthira, and the Ashwins in Nakula and Sahadeva. So, and yet Krishna said to take birth among the Yadus, and the Pandavas are supposed to be the Bharatas. Actually, the only human blood, or the only human DNA the Pandavas have is Yadu dynasty. Because Kunti, of course, Kunti Devi is a Yadu queen, the wife of Pandu. Kunti is a Yadu, and the only human DNA the Pandavas have is from the Yadu dynasty. But because by Vedic principles, their father is Pandu, therefore they're called the, you know, Kurus or Bharatas. But actually, they're genetically they're Yadus, and therefore they're from the same dynasty as Krishna, and also Krishna's cousins. So Krishna makes that decision, and then what happens is, if you look at the political landscape at that time, another very powerful kingdom, of course, is the Yadu themselves. The Yadus are very powerful. And so what do the Asuras do? One of the most powerful Asuras, the one who, in the eighth canto, the first Asura to attack Vishnu, when Vishnu came to help the demigods, when Vishnu came riding on Garuda, he didn't attack the Asuras, he just showed up and said, okay, he stopped the illegal weapons that the Asuras were using, and that's all he did, didn't attack anyone. But then one of the demons, the most impetuous, the most envious Asura, Kalanemi, he rushed at Vishnu and attacked. And of course, he threw his trident at Vishnu, like this cosmic trident. You know, you'd need like great computer graphics to really show this in a movie. And he throws it at Garuda. The first thing he wants to do, Kalanemi is not the brightest Asura. And so he first attacks Garuda, thinking that if he kills Garuda, you know, well, then Vishnu will just fall down or something. So anyway, so Vishnu grabs this spear, this trident, and he throws it back, at his own weapon, back at Kalanemi. So he throws it so hard that it goes right through Kalanemi, who's mounted on this, like this celestial lion. And it goes right through the lion and just, boom, just kills both of them. Now that Kalanemi, who was the most impetuous, the most like envious, like violent Asura, he takes as his personal job because he wants to get revenge against the Lord. He wants revenge. And therefore he takes birth in the Lord's own dynasty. He takes birth as Kamsa. And that's why Kamsa is always, what's the word, sort of Krishna-phobic. He's always really nervous because, because Krishna killed him and he wants to kill Krishna. That's why when he hears, that's why he's, when he's driving the chariot of his cousin sister, Devaki, and her new husband, Vasudev, and... he's trying to be a nice guy. My sister drive their, they're basically their pre-industrial limousine. He's driving their wedding limousine. And so then he thinks everything's okay, life is good. But then he hears this voice from the sky, which tells him the worst possible news. He says that actually your sister is going to give birth to Vishnu. To Krishna, her eighth son. And so he's so violent. I mean, because if you compare Kamsa to Jarasandha, they're very different personalities. Jarasandha is much more sophisticated. He's much more, even though he's actually more powerful than Kamsa. And he takes birth as a, sort of like a king. He has an army. Where is Kamsa's army? When do you ever hear about Kamsa just having a normal army? Kings have armies. Kamsa never leads an army. And when Jarasandha attacks Krishna, he does it by the rules. He comes with an army, and they have a normal, conventional battle. Whereas Kamsa, he doesn't have a regular army. I mean, he's very powerful himself. He's very sneaky. He sends all these, like, yogi demons to Vrindavan to take different shapes. Like, they always try to trick. It's all tricks and cheating and changing shape. And, first Putana comes in and just, like, sort of like, I don't know, Miss Mathura. And she comes into Vrindavan, but it's actually this hideous Putana. And so if you look at Kamsa's personality, extremely violent, extremely just like passionate and wild. And whereas Jarasandha is very different. He's much more mature. But anyway, so when Kamsa hears this, he immediately grabs his sister and he's going to just literally... just cut her throat or cut her head off. It's just this poor, on her wedding day, like, well, this is my wedding present for you. So the whole story kind of unfolds, but apart from that, the Asuras have taken over the great dynasty originally from Chedi and now in Magadha, now sort of centered in Magadha, the very dynasty that was meant to protect the earth, and then Kamsa takes over the Yadu dynasty. So the very dynasty in which the demigods, through their empowerment, are supposed to appear, and the very dynasty in which Krishna is going to appear, he takes over that dynasty. So this is becoming a major problem for Bhumi, for the earth goddess, because the demons are actually winning in a sense. They're outsmarting the demigods. And then if you look at Duryodhana, These are, in a sense, the three greatest asuras in the whole story. There's Jarasandha, and then the next generation is Kamsa, and the next generation is Duryodhana. And Duryodhana is actually, in a sense, the most sophisticated. Duryodhana has the most sophisticated strategy because he actually doesn't attack Krishna. I mean, one time he goes a little crazy just before the battle of Kurukshetra and tries to arrest Krishna. He doesn't even really want to kill him. He's not that stupid, but he thinks he can maybe, like, keep him or do something to him. But Duryodhana, most of the time, tries to actually win over Krishna. He keeps saying, he keeps whining to Krishna, come on, Krishna, we're all family. Why are you favoring the Pandavas? And so you see, actually, all three demons had very different strategies. Although Kamsa was dependent on Jarasandha. So anyway, if you look at the whole story, what was actually going on... So then, of course, Krishna comes and the demigods empower the Pandavas, and the story unfolds. But it's very interesting. So I gave you some of the background. This is what actually leads up to Krishna's appearance. So, any questions on these points? Yes.
You're mentioning that the
Vasudeva. Oh, King Vasu, right, yeah. Right, King Vasu.
I mean, the whole story actually happens in India. It's the same India that we know today, And if so, what about the rest of the world? What about the Europe?
Right.
Why does the whole story of the demons and demigods happen in India?
Yeah. Yeah, what was going on in Philadelphia? So, so roughly, if you look at the geography of the Mahabharata story, if we use modern names or the conventional idea of what these names indicate, then the story roughly takes place in South Asia, but extending all the way, certainly in Afghanistan, and probably eastern Iran, on the northeast. It even there are even people from western Turkey or even Greece, because the sea which between Greece and Turkey, that sea is called the Ionian Sea, and from the word Ionia, the word Yavana. So you could say that it extends northwest all the way into Afghanistan, maybe parts of Iran. It extends west into, into Greece. And as far as the east, it certainly goes all the way to, the far east of India. For example, it certainly goes all the way to the countries bordering the Bay of Bengal. Not so much South India. I mean, South India, the South India, what they call Peninsular India, really becomes, it really is involved mainly when, you have these, like the Rajasuya sacrifices, Digvijaya, like conquering the directions, where you have to conquer all directions to establish yourself as an emperor. So Sahadev goes south to deal with the South Indian. But mostly they come from this northern area. And so what about the rest of the world? The first issue I would say is that we can't really be absolutely sure we know what these place names mean, these geographic names. For example, in South America, there's a country, Paraguay. And if you look at a map of South America, I don't know, like 100, 150 years ago, Paraguay was a huge country. I mean, it's one of the biggest countries in South America. But then Argentina and Brazil decided to get it, so they declared war and they cut it up, and now it's just little, it's like this little sort of kidney bean, it's just little Paraguay. Similarly, if you talk about Great Britain or the British Empire, once it meant a lot of things, now it means what it means. And so or even like the word Israel, I mean Israel, what was Israel under Solomon, what was Israel in 1950, what's Israel today? What will Israel be? So, as far as geographic names, we can't say absolutely what these names meant, and so we can't rule out the possibility that this extended into southern Europe or even northern Europe. And as far as China, I mean, Chinese people are mentioned. The Chinese people are mentioned because they sent tribute. I think the Rajasuya sacrifice, but they're not like major players. We have to remember something, that consider the two world wars. Consider World War One. I mean, it's called World War One, and yet it really took place, most of it took place just like within maybe like 100 square miles or, a few hundred square miles. It just took place basically on that, the Verdun, that line where, anyway, I could tell you all about the World War One, the geography and how it started, but so, and yet it's a world war, because the point is, when there is empire or when you have powerful kingdoms, then a battle in the capital city is a battle for the world. For example, if you look at the history of the Roman Empire, and even if you look at before it officially became an empire, even in the century before Christ, when they had all these civil wars between like these warlords, which took over Rome. I mean, they made a big problem. I mean, Rome, they tried so hard to keep things like republican and no dictatorship. For example, they had no king. I mean, that's why they called Augustus the emperor, because you couldn't say king. And so, Rex. And so imperatore just meant really just like, the manager. And so the reason they used that word is because you couldn't use the word king. And yet, they made a big mistake. And that is, they thought it would be financially a good idea rather than Rome having to pay all the soldiers, which was a huge expense because they had a lot of soldiers, and to motivate the generals, they said that, okay, this is in the century before Christ, like the first century BC, they said that the generals should conquer other places and pay their soldiers. So that way it motivates the generals to go out there and be aggressive and, you know, fight hard. And it motivates the soldiers, and also it reduces the expenses of Rome. Unfortunately, what happened is that the army became loyal to their generals. And so at that time, you entered a period where you had all these civil wars, because basically different powerful generals like Sulla and then Marius and just all these generals would come and just take over, because their soldiers were loyal to them, not to the Roman constitution. And then the person who actually stopped all the civil wars and restored peace, controversial figure, you like him or don't like him, but I tend to like him, though he's not perfect. The person that stopped these civil wars was Julius Caesar. And the reason Julius Caesar was assassinated was because he was like a real man. He was like a real man of the troops. He was just like, he would eat with his soldiers, you know, he would sleep with them. He was really and so he refused to have bodyguards in Rome. That's actually why he was killed, because he just wanted to be a regular citizen. But anyway, enough about Julius Caesar. So what was I saying? I got into this whole Roman thing. Yeah, so they had all these battles in Rome. So the fight took place in Rome, but they were fighting for the world. They were fighting for the Roman world. They were fighting for a huge piece of the world. And so in the same way, in terms of the Mahabharata, you know, maybe they weren't, I mean, were they really concerned, or did they know about, let's say, the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere? Like what was going on in the Amazon jungle, or what was going on in the Andes Mountains, or in the, you know, the American prairies or plains? Or maybe not. Maybe not, because if you look at empires, how should I put it? I think there's no question at that time, the highest civilization in the world was there in India, South Asia. I mean, even if you look at, I mean, India does not have a history of invading other countries. In fact, Vedic culture or Sanskrit culture, it spread to Southeast Asia without violence, just because people recognize it as superior culture. That's why if you look at Southeast Asia, so many geographic names are Sanskrit, like Singapura. You know, Nrisinghapur. I mean, Singapore just means Lion City, Singapura. Or in Indonesia, Java, which means, you know, Java, Sumatra. The biggest island in Indonesia is Sumatra, and Sumatra means very big. The island of Bali, the old name of Thailand, which is Siam, Shama Sundar. And so the reason you have all this Sanskrit, all these Sanskrit names, and you have Garuda Airlines for Indonesia, and in the center of Jakarta, there's a big statue of Krishna driving Arjuna's chariot. And so the reason for this, the culture just spread because people recognize it as a higher culture. And so in that sense, from the point of view of people in that Bharatvarsha, that Vedic civilization, they were not, how should I put it, they may have thought that, is it really worth crossing the ocean to deal with these people? I mean, really? Do you want to go? No? Do you want to go? And so, so that's basically what we can, again, we don't know exactly what these geographic names refer to. They could have referred to much larger areas. But the world they were concerned with, the world they considered to be civilized and important for maintaining high levels of human civilization, that's the world they fought for. Any other question? Stop here?
You can stop here. And there is some kind of sweets or something like this to distribute.
Oh. Thank you all very much. As Elvis Presley used to say, you've been a great audience.
Hare Krishna.
שבוע הבא ביום שבת, יום שישי זה פנדה ויקדשי, אנחנו עוקפים אותו.
When is פנדה ויקדשי?
Friday. So we bypass it by.
Yes, prepare.
Okay.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yes. What's your name?
Kamalini.
Oh, Kamalini. Who's your guru?
I don't have a
guru. Oh, it's very good. How'd you get the name?
My father is
Krishna. Oh, your father is Krishna. Oh, I'm so happy you came. Such a beautiful young lady. I'm really happy.